Hi, welcome to this Physicians Weekly's podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm your host for this podcast, and today we've got some great interviews as usual.
This is Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to this week's Physicians Weekly podcast, episode 130. This week, we speak with our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney, this time to discuss the topic many physicians are asking themselves: what are the rules regarding artificial intelligence, or AI, and liability? Our second guest is Dr. Sabi George, who is a professor of medical oncology at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in Buffalo, New York, who recently presented the results from the CheckMate 67T trial at ASCO's Genitourinary Cancer Symposium. The pharmacokinetic, or PK, study compared subcutaneously administered nivolumab to intravenously administered nivolumab in patients with advanced kidney cancer. What's really interesting about this and why Physicians Weekly decided to interview Dr. George is to discuss the impact that this particular trial could have on all cancer types that use nivolumab in their treatment arsenal. Enjoy listening.
Physicians Weekly is back again with our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney. This time to discuss AI and liability. Dr. Medlaw, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here.
So, AI is the thing now, and its role in medicine will only increase, but doctors are concerned about liability issues that it may present.
Well, AI is definitely here to stay, and it will require adaptation in research conduct and in the practice of care and the evaluation of care. And all of those can extend to the courtroom.
Let's start with the research issue. I understand that turning in a paper that was significantly done by AI can ruin a researcher's reputation. But where would legal liability come in?
Two ways. One would be a breach of contract issue, and the other would be getting sued for defamation or wrongful termination.
How would this be a contract issue?
Research is generally funded by an institution or an interest group or a corporation. So the researcher gets a grant. And when they do so, it's really under an agreement that they're going to meet certain standards in their work. And chief among them is that the person who qualified for the grant will be doing the work. You know, that's really like an implied warranty that they make when they take the money. So if you turn over the project to this algorithm generator or to a robot writer, you're obviously not in compliance with that agreement. And if the work is revealed to have been conducted significantly by AI in a way that was not a contemplated part of its plan, you've thereby breached the agreement with the funder. So the researcher would not only be liable for the funds they were paid, you know, they'd have to disgorge those, and they may have already spent them. But it would also be a liability situation for any operational or reputational damage that the sponsor suffered because it got revealed that the research that they were going around touting was actually done by AI. And all that bad stuff is the case even if the AI use is accurate. And it's going to be a lot worse if it's not accurate.
What are you referring to?
Well, AI hallucinates, and what that means is it presents false information as fact. Now, this has been pretty notorious in the legal field. I think a lot of people have heard about the case in New York where this filing had these really slam dunk on point perfect precedents, and none of them actually existed. The AI had made them up. And this problem really gets worse when a field is complex and when it requires nuance. And medical research is both. And it's also a feature of inadequate training of the AI. And that can be a factor when research is really specialized and it's really a first impression situation that you don't have a lot of background to train the AI with.
So what is the obligation of the researcher to deal with this?
Well, this is not intentional falsehood on the part of the person who's submitting the work. They didn't ask the AI to lie. So the problem is that they failed to check what the AI generated. But you know, what you don't check, someone else will. So that legal case was caught because the firm on the other side which had done extensive research, they get this filing and they say, wait a second, we never saw any of these cases. And we know that we did wide research. So they checked for them individually and they found they did, just didn't exist. So they informed the judge. Now, sponsors of research and journals, they're going to be doing more double checking as well now, because the problem of AI has been publicized. And if a result or a citation just looks too tailor-made, they'll be checking on it. So you got to check first.
But does that mean that AI should not be used in research?
Oh, no, absolutely not. It has a vital role. It's good for developing models, for streamlining procedures, for writing summaries. But, you know, it's really always a good idea to keep in mind what Spock said in The Ultimate Computer, which really, you know, that was back in the 60s, but it was a really prescient consideration of the limits of AI. And he said that computers are excellent and efficient servants, but I have no wish to serve under them.
You had mentioned wrongful termination claims with regard to AI in the research setting. How is that an issue?
Well, it kicks in when someone working under you submits work that, you know, it looks really different from what you expected. You know, it's too good. And you become suspicious that they're improperly using an AI source. Now, the problem is that, you know, just hitting them with an accusation and maybe ruining their career, or just tossing them off the study summarily, and that study is, you know, not just part of their career, but it's supplying their income. You know, you do that kind of thing based solely on a hunch, and it can get you sued for defamation or wrongful termination.
So how should the determination be made?
Well, the underlying issues are not unique to AI. You know, faking results or engaging in plagiarism, those are not new issues. And lead researchers always have to consider that they may be occurring. The problem is that when AI is involved, the methods of checking change. I mean, if you think that someone has plagiarized, for example, you can just block a segment of the suspect text, put it in the search engine will find it in the place it was plagiarized from. But how do you deal with work that's actually newly generated, but it was really generated by the AI? You know, this is like trying to prove that someone's mom wrote their term paper. So the tendency is to try to use another AI system to check. You know, you just dump in the material and you ask whether that was created. This actually came up recently at Texas A&M University, and it was about class papers, not research. But the principle is the same. The faculty member had accused his students of using AI on their final assignments, and he refused to, you know, evaluate those assignments for class credit. He actually said, I don't grade AI bullshit. So what happened was seniors had their diplomas held back because they now lacked the course credit to graduate. The problem was that his entire assessment process was wrong. What he had done was he had copied and pasted their work into ChatGPT, and the bot spit back that it had authored every single one of them, so he gave the entire class an X. The thing is, though, ChatGPT is not a checker system. It's not designed to identify AI-generated content at all, and it also lies about what it does. You know, it claims to have written Crime and Punishment when that was fed to it. So you can't use these systems to check if AI was used fraudulently in your own work.
What is the preferable method, then?
Well, there are specific AI detection systems, and these claim accuracy is up to 99%. So that's a first step for guidance. Now, supposing the checker system gives you the response that, yeah, this thing was done by an AI, do you just slam down on the person? And the answer is no. What you do if there seems to be a high likelihood of it being AI generated, that just triggers the need to have a private discussion. You know, you allow the researcher to offer their own explanation. Now, they might be in the 1% that's incorrectly flagged, or there may be an innocent explanation for the AI use. They mistakenly thought that it was only a style enhancement, and so you can correct that. If you're still unsatisfied, if you really do think that, you know, that this is a problem of AI cheating, then you step aside. You bring the matter to the supervising body at the facility or at the sponsor. You do it in writing, very fact-based, no editorialization, nothing inflammatory. Let them be the ones to do the investigation. Let them be the ones to do any exclusions.
But most doctors are not researchers, and their concern is going to the second issue that you mentioned, evaluating what they do clinically with AI in the mix, and they are particularly worried about how that can affect their malpractice liability.
Well, there are two levels there. The first one is about notes, and the second is about clinical decision making.
Let's start with the notes aspect.
Well, that's the easy one because it's literally unchanged as far as the doctor's legal obligation from when the doctor writes their own note or when the doctor uses a human scribe. The ultimate responsibility for what goes out in the chart or out in a letter to a consultant or a referrer remains with the doctor. And this is important because AI is moving past mere transcription to these large language models that actually decide what's important. And they then create full notes that can just be, you know, popped over then into an EMR system. You know, what doctors call talking to the patient and writing a soap note, the tech people call taking unstructured text as input and producing structured data as output. You know, they treat them as comparable acts of information transfer.
But are they really? Is even a trained AI still as clinically nuanced as a human physician?
Well, frankly, the accuracy of these systems has not been well established yet. But even if they turn out to be really accurate, the duty of the doctor is unchanged. So the vendors of these systems, they actually prominently state in their own marketing that these notes are only intended as drafts. Now, they're covering themselves for error liability. But even though that's self-serving, it's legally correct. The doctor who puts out a note under their own name is fully liable for its content, and you can't delegate that to an AI system any more than you could to a human scribe. The problem is when the doctor who's probably only using the AI system because they're overburdened with paperwork and computer time, and who may also unconsciously endow the automated system with greater trust than they might a human scribe, then fails to check. By the way, this means that it's essential to not assume that the AI will get everything as you speak to the patient. Now, AI use in the patient encounter setting is promoted as, you know, freeing the doctor to converse naturally with the patient. But the doctor really still does need to keep good track of what is said, just as if they were simultaneously creating a note, because the AI may leave out a point that actually mattered. You know, in other words, you have to stay as alert as when you were creating the note yourself. And I just want to say that a real value of AI in this regard is that it generates the note quickly. You know, if you've ever used ChatGPT, you know it comes up on the screen in seconds. So you can review that note while the encounter is still fresh in your memory. You want to take advantage of that feature.
So the take-home lesson is simple as to notes. Check and edit before you sign, because that note can someday be evidence.
I couldn't have said it better.
Now, how about decision-making? What if an AI system makes a finding and the doctor disagrees with it, and there is eventually a lawsuit? Doesn't that hurt the doctor severely?
Well, there are really two questions here. The first one is, does the introduction of AI into the clinical mix change the legally applicable standard of care? And then the second one is the fact that the doctor did or did not follow the AI input going to sway the jury? So let's start with the standard of care.
Okay.
All right. The standard of care is best understood by the way it will be phrased on a question to an expert at trial. Good and accepted medical practice. So it's coupled to the legal standard that being non-negligent means acting clinically reasonably under the actual circumstances. AI doesn't change either of those. In fact, to actually be clinically useful, the AI should have been trained using data that conforms to the standard of care. It should embody it.
So then the real problem is when the doctor does not follow the AI, which is now going to be presented as the arbiter of the right thing to do.
Exactly. You know, going back to Star Trek, we've all grown up with Star Trek in one or more of its incarnations. And there's now a deep inclination in the public, and that's a public from which jurors and judges will be drawn, to believe that an automated system like the Enterprise computer or Commander Data is superior to human perceptions and analysis, and to now cast the AI into that pre-existing trust mold. Now, that the trier of fact, whether it's a judge in a bench trial or a jury, might be swayed by the argument that the AI provided the right answer and the doctor disregarded that guidance, well, that worry is not unfounded. But when you remove, you know, the flash of AI, the defense issues really have not changed.
What do you mean?
Well, let's start with breaking down why the AI was not followed. If the reason is negligence, you know, the doctor never even looked at the AI findings, settle the case, write the check. However, if the doctor was aware of the AI finding but didn't follow it, then we're just in the same territory as we've always been when a doctor's actions do not conform to a textbook or a journal article or a facility guideline or a society guideline. In that situation, the defense is for the doctor to show why the recommendation was actually not applicable to the care of that patient at that time. So AI has to be explained as a factor that, just like textbooks, journals, and guidelines, has input into clinical judgment but doesn't substitute for it. So if the doctor can show why it was more reasonable to not follow the AI, then they have their defense. And a smart defense attorney can toss in Spock's quote about using AI but not being subservient to it there.
But the AI looked at the actual case, while a textbook or a journal article or a guideline only gives general guidance.
Well, that's a great point. And in that regard, AI is more like, a colleague who's acting as a co-evaluator. But there's also no obligation to agree with a colleague if a clinically reasonable case can be made to have done otherwise. And that this presentation of AI like it was a colleague, it does lead us to an actual logistical problem in proving a case at trial. AI can't be cross-examined like a human colleague could be. And this is a problem because the usual hedge against that, you know, having this unsworn expert like a textbook or an AI, is the hearsay rule, which excludes testimony from remote sources. But the AI report is going to come in under the exception that the rule makes for the medical record, so you lose that set off.
So how would this situation be dealt with?
Well, the AI system itself can be challenged. You put on an expert witness in computer systems to talk about the limits on what it actually did and how it actually did it. The actual defense point, though, will not be trying to undermine the system, but to emphasize that it's only a threshold tool that's then subject to human review, interpretation, analysis, assessment. For example, NYU publicizes that it has integrated AI into its breast imaging protocol by using it as, and they use the term, second reader. So it's not treated like an oracle that overrides the doctor, but as a companion alert system that may make the doctor reconsider their own assessment.
May?
Well, exactly. Justifying overruling the AI's assessment will then be no different from any other defense of your own reasoning against a written source or a human expert, with a criteria to make the call that you actually met.
The same approach would also apply when the doctor follows the AI, but the plaintiff is claiming that that was incorrect, right?
Yes. Just as disregarding the AI is not a death knell for a case, following the AI is not a get-out-of-liability-free card. The doctor is in the position of the last clear chance to avoid an AI input that's actually wrong from translating into care.
What is the best way to document these situations?
You want to specifically mention what the AI said and why you then acted either in accordance with it or counter to it. So the trier of fact should be able to go back with you to your process at the time and see that you did pay attention to what the AI said and then concluded that it was or was not correct and appropriate in that case.
Dr. Medlaw, thank you again for being with us.
Thanks for a chance to talk about this important topic.
Next, we have a quick interview with Dr. Sabi George about the pharmacokinetic or PK outcomes of the CheckMate 67T trial.
I just wanted to thank you for your time, Dr. George. Could you just briefly introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your interests?
Hello, I'm Dr. Sabi George. I'm a professor of medical oncology at Roswell Park Cancer Institute, Buffalo, New York. And
great.
I specialize in the care of kidney, bladder, and prostate cancer patients.
Important work. So I actually saw you speak a few weeks ago in San Francisco, and you were talking about the CheckMate 67T trial. And could you just start off by giving us a little synopsis of what that's about and what the key take-home messages were?
Yeah, CheckMate 67T is a large randomized phase 3 open-label trial of subcutaneously administered nivolumab versus intravenously administered nivolumab in patients with advanced kidney cancer who had prior treatments. So this was a PK study for non-inferiority, basically trying to prove that the subcutaneously administered nivolumab is non-inferior to the traditional intravenously administered nivolumab. As you know, nivolumab is approved for use in 22 different indications across many tumor types. And so testing the PK for non-inferiority of sub-Q will create the rationale for using in other diseases as well. But this was a large trial done in kidney cancer patients. The schema of the trial is like this. You know, patients with advanced kidney cancer who had 1 to 2 prior systemic treatments and no prior immunotherapy agents were enrolled in the trial, stratified using IMDC risk grouping and baseline weight. They were randomized in a 1-to-1 fashion to receive subcutaneous nivolumab at 1,200 milligram, along with RHUPH-20 every 4 weeks, or nivolumab IV 3 milligram per kilogram every 2 weeks, which is the originally approved version from 2015. The co-primary endpoints were C-average day 28 and C-minimum steady state. They are the PK endpoints. And the key power secondary endpoint was objective response rate. So then patients were enrolled across 17 countries and at 75 centers. And after a minimum follow-up of 8 months, this data were generated. And then, you know, the study basically showed that it met the co-primary endpoints for non-inferiority, meaning the subcutaneously administered nivolumab was non-inferior to intravenously administered nivolumab in terms of PK, as well as the secondary power secondary endpoint of objective response rate by blinded independent central review also met the non-inferiority threshold, making it a positive study. And safety was also very comparable between the two arms. And progression-free survival seen in the sub-Q arm was 7.23 months, and IV nivolumab was 5.65 months. So basically, you know, the results are pretty similar, and this makes a positive study. So hoping that this will get approved for use.
Right. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed because that would be great. So what are the kind of, you know, implications that this sort of study has? Should it be FDA approved? How will it affect the day-to-day experience that patients have?
Yeah. So currently, nivolumab is administered over 30 minutes or so. Patient occupies the chair for approximately 1 hour. In this study, the subcutaneously administered nivolumab took only 5 minutes
right
for administration, and that's once in 4 weeks. So that means this treatment, if it gets approved, I mean, single agent nivolumab can be moved to in the clinics for administration instead of the infusion center. Taking 1 hour, and infusion center, they have to make an appointment, they have to have additional wait times, et cetera, and a chair time. While subcutaneously administered nivolumab can be given like bone modifying agent, denosumab, or even like a Lupron in the clinic.
That's right. That offers a lot of options for people perhaps in remote areas.
Oh, absolutely. So similar in Buffalo, you know, we have outside the city, we have a lot of remote, you know, village type areas with a lot of farmlands and stuff, you know, and people are overwhelmed to come to, you know, big cities. So if we have like a clinic closer to them, it's easier to administer that. And moreover, elderly patients, sometimes they don't have the ride all the time to come to, you know, big centers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a satellite clinic where, you know, this can be given instead of patient having to drive or travel to the infusion centers. It will make it very easy.
So the treatment burden definitely sounds like there's a huge advantage of that. What about presumed costs? Because I know that generally speaking, people kind of assume that a sub-Q treatment will be cheaper. However, I know in non-small cell lung cancers, in any case, the doses might have to be increased to achieve the same pharmacokinetics. So is that one of the values of the 670 study? Is that perhaps...
Yeah, the dose was 1,200 milligrams of nivolumab opposed to 3 mg per kilogram in the IV arm. So it's a higher dose, of course, but definitely the PK values were known inferior, you know, with the ease of administration. So with the different routes of administration, the bioavailability varies. So for example, there are some drugs which can be given orally, some drug can be given perrectally and as an intramuscular injection, or some of them can be given intravenously. Well, intravenously given a drug is right there. All of it is in the you know, intravenous compartment, right there after the infusion or injection. While the other routes, you know, need to get absorbed from that route into the bloodstream. So that's a challenge. It's not unique for subcutaneous. It's seen with all the other routes of administration. And that's why higher dose is needed to achieve the you know, PK parameters. And which this study was able to show that this achieved it. While the cost may be determined by the manufacturer and the methodology in manufacturing and all those things. So I have no idea how that's going to... I can say one thing. The infusion chair cost for 1 hour will be eliminated.
For 2 hours, right? Because it's every 4 weeks instead of every 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. I mean, it has the option to be given every 4 weeks at a flat dose of 480, but the tested dose was every 2 weeks because that's the one which was approved originally by FDA in 2015.
So what about other indications? Do we see this happening in other cancer types?
So since this was a PK study, the results are applicable to all the cancers where nivolumab is used.
Right.
So, you know, moreover, you know, when you look at the approval of biosimilar compounds, they just have PK studies.
That's right.
And they don't have large phase 3 trials. But this is a large phase 3 trial with PK and objective response rate as endpoints. So this really giving us a lot of confidence in saying that this really works the way it should work. And just like the IV nivolumab, and safety is very similar, and PK is similar, response rate similar, PFS is similar. And there should be enough rationale for using all the other indications where at least nivolumab is used as single agent. While, you know, combination, I can't comment on that because that's not what we studied, but I don't think it will be any different because the PK is very similar. And moreover, there were other studies of nivolumab in the past where different doses were tested and there were no dose-response relationship.
I see.
And immunotherapy agents, checkpoint inhibitors like a PD-1 blocker, in this case like nivolumab, they usually don't have a high ceiling dose. They could have a response, a low dose and a high dose. They could have an adverse event at a low dose and a high dose. And there's no dose-response relationship. So ideally, it could be applicable in every indication. That's my opinion. But again, I would leave that up for FDA and you know, authorities to decide how this will be utilized. I'm having no place to comment on that.
Thank you so much for your time. If you have any other further comments, sir.
One more little comment about, you pointed out that, you know, patients in the, you know, rural areas, they may be able to access this easier. So improving access actually is tied to disparities.
Exactly. We see this as an equity advantage. So this is going to be improving equity.
Absolutely. So it may somehow reduce the disparity, I would say, in some extent, at least relating to access. So that's an opportunity. And I think, you know, it should be optimally used to make it better for all the patients.
Great place to end. So thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Thanks for listening to Physicians Weekly. Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.